Chapter 2. It was preternaturally quiet inside. No sound penetrated from the night out of which he had come. Farrah walked forward gingerly on a carpeted floor that deadened his footsteps. His eyes accustomed themselves to the soft lighting, which came like a reflection from the walls and ceiling. He had expected ultra-normalness. The ordinariness of the atomic lighting acted like a tonic to his tense nerves. He glanced around with gathering confidence. The place looked normal enough. It was a shop, scantily furnished. There were showcases on the walls and on the floor, lovely things, but nothing unusual, and not many of them, a dozen. There was, in addition, a double door leading to a back room. Farrah tried to keep one eye on that door as he examined several showcases, each with three or four weapons, either mounted or arranged in boxes or holsters. With narrowed eyes, he estimated his chances of grabbing one of the weapons from a case, and then, the moment someone came, force him outside where Jor would perform the arrest. Behind him, a man said quietly, "You wish to buy a gun?" Farrah turned with a jump. Brief rage flooded him at the way his plan had been wrecked by the arrival of the clerk. The anger died as he saw that the clerk was a fine-looking, silver-haired man older than himself. That was disconcerting. Farrah had an immense and almost automatic respect for age. He said at last, lamely, "Yes, yes, a gun." "For what purpose?" said the man in his quiet voice. Farrah could only look at him. He wanted to get mad. He wanted to tell these people what he thought of them. But the age of this representative locked his tongue. He managed speech with an effort of will. "For hunting." The plausible words stiffened his mind. "Yes, definitely for hunting. There is a lake to the north of here," he went on more fulsomely, "and..." He stopped, scowling at the extent of his dishonesty. He was not prepared to go so deeply into prevarication. He said curtly, "For hunting." Farrah was himself again. He hated the man for having put him so completely at a disadvantage. With smoldering eyes, he watched the old fellow click open a showcase and take out a green shining rifle. As the man faced him, weapon in hand, Farrah was thinking, "Pretty clever having an old man as a front." It was the same kind of cunning that had made them choose the property of Miser Harris. He reached for the gun, but the man held it out of his reach. "Before I can even let you test this," he said, "I am compelled by the bylaws of the weapon shops to inform you under what circumstances you may purchase a gun." So they had private regulations. What a system of psychological tricks to impress the gullible. "We weapon makers," the clerk was saying mildly, "have evolved guns that can, in their particular range, destroy any machine or object made of what is called matter. Thus, whoever possesses one of our weapons is more than a match for any soldier of the Empress. I say more because each gun is the center of a field of force which acts as a perfect screen against immaterial destructive forces. That screen offers no resistance to clubs or spears or bullets or other material substances, but it would require a small atomic cannon to penetrate the superb barrier it creates around its owner." "You will readily comprehend," the man went on, "that such a potent weapon could not be allowed to fall, unmodified, into irresponsible hands. Accordingly, no gun purchased from us may be used for aggression or murder. In the case of the hunting rifle, only such specified game birds and animals as we may from time to time list in our display windows may be shot. Finally, no weapon can be resold without our approval. Is that clear?" Farrah nodded. For the moment, speech was impossible to him. He wondered if he ought to laugh out loud or curse the man for daring to insult his intelligence. So the gun mustn't be used for murder or robbery. So only certain birds and animals could be shot. And as for reselling it, suppose he bought this thing, took a trip of 1,000 miles, and offered it to some wealthy stranger for 2 credits. Who would ever know? Or suppose he held up a stranger, or shot him. How would the weapon shop ever find out? He grew aware that the gun was being held out to him stock first. He took it and had to fight the impulse to turn the muzzle directly on the old man. "How does it work?" he asked. "You simply aim it and pull the trigger. Perhaps you would like to try it on a target we have." Farrah swung the gun up. "Yes," he said triumphantly, "and you're it. Now just get over there to the front door, and then outside." He raised his voice. "And if anybody's thinking of coming through the back door, I've got that covered, too." He motioned jerkily at the clerk. Quick now, move. I'll shoot. I swear I will. The man was cool, unflustered. I have no doubt you would. When we decided to attune the door so that you could enter despite your hostility, we assumed a capacity for homicide. However, this is our party. You had better adjust yourself accordingly and look behind you. There was silence. Finger on trigger, Ferris stood moveless. Dim thoughts came of all the half-things he had heard in his days about the weapon shops, that they had secret supporters in every district, that they had a private and ruthless hidden government, and that once you got into their clutches, the only way out was death. But what finally came clear was a mind picture of himself. Farrah Clark, family man, faithful subject of the Empress, standing here in this dimly lighted store, deliberately fighting so vast and menacing an organization. He forced courage into his sagging muscles. He said, "You can't fool me by pretending there's someone behind me. Now, get to that door." The firm eyes of the old man were looking past him. The man said quietly, "Well, Rad, have you all the data?" "Enough for a primary," said a young man's voice behind Farrah. "Type A7, conservative. Good average intelligence, but a monaric development peculiar to small towns. One-sided outlook fostered by the imperial schools, present in exaggerated form. Extremely honest. Reason would be useless. Emotional approach would require extended treatment. I see no reason why we should bother. Let him live his life as it suits him." "If you think," Ferris said shakily, "that the trick voice is going to make me turn, you're crazy. That's the left wall of the building. I know there's no one there." "I'm all in favor, Rad," said the old man, "of letting him live his life. But he was the prime mover of the crowd outside. I think he should be discouraged." "We'll advertise his presence," said Rad. "He'll spend the rest of his life denying the charge." Ferris' confidence in the gun had faded so far that, as he listened in puzzled uneasiness to the incomprehensible conversation, he forgot it completely. The old man said persistently, "I think a little emotion might have a long-run effect. Show him the palace." "Palace?" The word tore Farrah out of his paralysis. "See here," he began, "I can see now that you lied to me. This gun isn't loaded at all. It's..." His voice failed him. His body went rigid. There was no gun in his hand. "Why, you..." he began wildly, and stopped again. His mind heaved with imbalance. He fought off the spinning sensation, thought finally, tremblingly, "Somebody must have sneaked the gun from him. That meant there was someone behind him." The voice was no mechanical thing. He started to turn, and couldn't. He struggled, pushing with his muscles, and couldn't turn, couldn't move, couldn't budge. The room was growing curiously dark. He had difficulty seeing the old man. He would have shrieked then if he could, because the weapon shop was gone. He was standing in the sky above an immense city, standing in the sky and nothing around him but air and a blue summer heaven and the city a mile, 2 miles below. His breath seemed solidly embedded in his lungs. Sanity came back as the remote awareness impinged on his mind that he was actually standing on a hard floor and that the city must be a picture somehow focused directly into his eyes. For the first time, with a start, Farrah recognized the metropolis below. It was the city of dreams, imperial city, capital of the glorious Empress Isher. From his great height, he could see the grounds of the Silver Palace, the imperial residence itself. The last tendrils of his fear were fading now before a gathering fascination and wonder. The fear vanished as he recognized with a thrill that the palace was drawing nearer at tremendous speed. "Show him the palace," they had said. The glittering roof flashed straight at his face. The solid metal of it passed through him. His first sense of imminent and mind-shaking desecration came as the picture paused in a huge room, where a score of men sat around a table at the head of which sat a young woman. The inexorable, sacrilegious, limitlessly powered cameras that were doing the photographing swung across the table and caught the woman full face. It was a handsome face, but there was passion twisting it now, as she leaned forward and said in a voice at once familiar, how often Farrah had heard its calm, measured tones on the telestats, and distorted by anger and an insolent certainty of command. That caricature of a beloved voice slashed across the silence as clearly as if he were there in the great room.
I want that traitor killed, do you understand? I don't care how you do it, but I want to hear by tomorrow night that he is dead.
The picture snapped off, and instantly Farrow was back in the weapon shop. He stood for a moment swaying, fighting to accustom his eyes to the dimness. His first emotion was contempt at the simpleness of the trickery. A motion picture. What kind of a fool did they think he was to swallow something as transparently unreal as that? Abruptly, the appalling depravity of the scheme, the indescribable wickedness of what was being attempted here, brought red rage.
Why, you scum, he flared. So you've got somebody to act the part of the Empress, trying to pretend that... Why, you...
That will do, said the voice of Rad. Farrah shook as a big young man walked into his line of vision. The alarm thought came that people who would besmirch so vilely the character of Her Imperial Majesty would not hesitate to do physical damage to Farrah Clark. The young man went on in a steely tone. We do not pretend that what you saw was taking place this instant in the palace. That would be too much of a coincidence. But it was taken 2 days ago. The woman is the Empress. The man whose death she ordered is a former advisor whom she considered a weakling. He was found dead in his apartment last night. His name, if you care to look it up in the news files, was Banton Vickers. However, let that pass. We're finished with you.
But I'm not finished, Farrah said in a thick voice. I've never heard or seen so much infamy in all my life. If you think this town is through with you, you're crazy. We'll have a guard on this place day and night, and nobody will get in or out.
That will do. It was the silver-haired man. The examination has been most interesting. As an honest man, you may call on us if you are ever in trouble. That is all. Leave through the side door. It was all. Impalpable forces grabbed him, and he was shoved at a door that appeared miraculously in the wall, where seconds before had been the palace. He found himself standing in a flower garden, and there was a crowd to his left. He recognized his fellow townsmen, and then he was outside. The nightmare was over. As he entered his house half an hour later, Creel said, Where's the gun?
The gun?
Farrah stared at his wife.
It said over the stat a few minutes ago that you were the first customer of the new weapon shop.
Farrah stood, remembering what the young man had said. We'll advertise his presence. He thought in agony. His reputation... Not that his was a great name, but he had long believed with a quiet pride that Farrah Clark's motor repair shop was widely known in the community and countryside. First, his private humiliation inside the shop, and now this lying to people who didn't know why he had gone into the store. He hurried to the telestat and called Mayor Dale. His hopes crashed as the pump man said, I'm sorry, Farrah. I don't see how you can have free time on the telestat. You'll have to pay for it. They did.
They did?
Farrah wondered if he sounded as empty as he felt. And they've paid Lan Harris for his lot. The old man asked top price and got it. He phoned me to transfer the title.
Oh.
Farrah's world was shattering.
You mean nobody's going to do anything?
What about the Imperial garrison at Ferd? Dimly, he was aware of the mayor mumbling something about the Empress soldiers refusing to interfere in civilian matters.
Civilian matters?
Farrah exploded. You mean these people are just going to be allowed to come here whether we want them or not, illegally forcing the sale of lots by first taking possession of them? A thought struck him.
Look, he said breathlessly, you haven't changed your mind about having Jor keep guard in front of the shop.
The plump face in the telestat plate grew impatient.
Now see here, Farrah, let the constituted authorities handle this matter.
But you're going to keep Jor there, Farrah said doggedly. The mayor looked annoyed.
I promised, didn't I? So he'll be there. And now do you want to buy time on the telestat? It's 15 credits for 1 minute. Mind you, as a friend, I think you're wasting your money. No one has ever caught up with a false statement.
Farrah said grimly, Put two on, one in the morning, one in the evening.
All right.
We'll deny it completely. Good night. The telestat went blank, and Farrah sat there. A new thought hardened his face. That boy of ours, there's going to be a showdown. He either works in my shop or he gets no more allowance.
Creel said, "You've handled him wrong. He's 23 and you treat him like a child. Remember, at 23 you were a married man."
"That was different," said Farah. "I had a sense of responsibility. Do you know what he did tonight?"
He didn't quite catch her answer. For a moment he thought, she said,
"No. In what way did you humiliate him first?"
Farah felt too impatient to verify the improbable words. He rushed on. "He refused in front of the whole village to give me help. He's a bad one, all bad."
"Yes," said Creel in a bitter tone. "He's all bad. I'm sure you don't realize how bad. He's as cold as steel, but without steel strength or integrity. He took a long time, but he hates even me now because I stood up for you for so long when I knew you were wrong."
"What's that?" said Farah, startled. Then gruffly, "Come, come, my dear, we're both upset. Let's go to bed."
He slept poorly.